some of the halachic considerations that go into the identification of men who have disappeared and the remains are found, and it's necessary to identify the body in order for the wife to remarry so she not be an aguna. And this relates to this week's parsha as well, Parsha's Kitetze, because the parsha speaks about Hashavas Aveda, we're told Adrosh Bayayim Cha, person finds an Aveda, they keep the Aveda Adrosh Achicha Sova Shivosa Lo Adrosh Achicha, that Arsheo Shlo Yehe Ramai, the person has to come and identify the Aveda through Simonim. And the Gemara in Baba Metzia says, "Darsheu im Ramayhu im Olo." A person comes to claim the simanim to identify an object. You have to determine whether they are honest or deceitful. How do you identify that? Ramay b'simanim. You identify if the person is able to give simanim. They're able to indicate what is special about this item or distinct about this item, so then you can return the item. Mikansha simanim d'araisa, the Gemara says, we see that there's a notion of simanim d'araisa. So the Mefarshim, Prima Gadim, Kesef Mishnah, speak about three different levels of simanim. There are simanim gruim, there are simanim beinonim, and there are simanim mufhakim. That when we derive that simanim are d'araisa, that you can rely upon the person giving identification, that means that it's some sort of a simon that would be distinct about this particular object. It's not true of lots and lots of objects. So a person shows up, and you have a pair of pants, and the person says, yeah, I lost a pair of pants. It's a black pair of pants. So 50% of the people in the neighborhood have pants that are black. It doesn't mean anything if the person says it's a black pair of pants. If they say it's a pair of pants and it happens to be, you know, this particular size, this particular dimension, so they got it this particular brand. So they already have a number of different indications that are not necessarily endemic to all pairs of pants. So then already you can trust the person and return the simanim. But even that's not considered to be good enough in order to be matir and eshes ish, in order to permit a woman to remarry, to identify somebody's body. So then the poskim say, based on the Gemara's in Yevamos, that we require simanim mufhakim. We require even a higher level. Can't just be like a simon that's not garua. A simon that is a little bit more special, like you remember that the person had a wart on his face. Okay, it's true, most people don't have warts. Maybe we would return an Aveda based on that type of identification for an object. But nonetheless, when it comes to identifying a person, we say that if you took a population of 1,000 people, maybe 5 of them would have a wart on their face. And therefore, that's not good enough in order to be matir a woman who would otherwise be an Eshes Sishli Alma. So we require a simen mufak. What exactly is the dimension? What exactly is the statistical probability for something in order to be a simen mufak? So the Maaseis Binyamin has a tshuva that's generally relied upon by most of poskim, in which he says that the margin of error has to be less than 1 in 1,000. If the margin of error is less than 1 in 1,000, so that's already considered to be so unusual and so unique that if you said, yeah, I remember that this man had a wart on his face, and the wart was exactly 2 inches tall, and it was exactly 1 centimeter thick, because I was the doctor and I have medical records to show that this was exactly the dimension of the wart. Okay, so most people don't have exactly the exact same dimension. This person has a crooked nose that's crooked in very specific dimensions. I'm the dentist and I have the dental records, and the person has the following configuration of teeth, and you're not going to find two people among 1,000 who have exactly the same configuration in terms of how their teeth are laid out. So you can rely upon that even to be matir and eshes ish. So in the aftermath of 9/11, what happened was that lots of people were incinerated or decimated in such a way that you couldn't just look at their bodies and determine who it was. If you could look at the body and see a person. You don't necessarily have to identify the size of the warts on their face, the size of the scars on their body, exactly what type of pants they wore and what type of shirt they wore and so forth and so forth, because you can simply rely upon Tzvias Ayin. Tzvias Ayin is considered to be a stronger simon. The Gemara in Chulin, you're learning Chulin this year, and Daf Tzadi Bab says that Tzvias Ayin is stronger than Simanim. That if you have Edim that come along and they're able to identify a killer based on Simanim, they say, yeah, I know the killer had a wart of a certain size on his face, and this person has a wart of that size, but they look at the person, they don't remember if this is the person who committed the murder. So we say that's not good enough. For putting somebody to death, that's not good enough. But what is good enough to put someone to death is that you have a lineup of possible suspects, right? You have the police lineup, and the witnesses who saw the murder look at all the people who are lined up, and they point to one person and say, yeah, I recognize that person. They wouldn't be able to tell you exactly what the specific simanim are. Just, I know him when I see him. I know the murderer when I look at the murderer. I know a person who I had recognized beforehand, and now, unfortunately, it's a dead corpse, but I'm looking at the person, and I can see that this is the same person. It's interesting, because when it comes to the retrieval of an Aveda, so we say that the Tefiyas Ayin is generally not good enough. If a person comes along and they say, oh yeah, I recognize this coat, this is my coat, because I recognize that it's my coat. So we don't give the coat to the person. So there's an obvious reason why not. We say, Darshei Shalo Yehei Ramai, that this person has a vested interest. They're cold and they want a coat. And they heard that there's a coat that's lost because somebody was mocked with a coat. So they may lie and say that I recognize this coat. Maybe they don't recognize the coat. So that's why we only rely upon Tefiyas Ayin when it comes to returning an Aveda. If somebody is a Tzorba Mirabban, and the Gemara in Bava Metzia says, if a person is a Tamach, and we know that the person never lies about anything unless it's appropriate. The Gemara gives three cases where it's appropriate to prevaricate a little bit. But otherwise, the person is always very truthful. So therefore, you can rely upon them even if they have a vested interest. When it comes to identifying a dead body, the people who are identifying the body either don't have a vested interest, or if they do, it could be the wife who identifies her husband's body. We still would rely upon that type of identification because of the fact that everybody understands how chamor it is, how serious a matter it is for an Eishes Isha to remarry. It's not just a question of receiving a coat that doesn't belong to you. The woman's going to be violating Issacharis. She's going to have children who are mamzerim. So we have more of a dispensation in where we say, for the sake of Takanas Agunos, that we believe people. We believe people when they testify. We believe them. So objectively speaking, Tefiyas Ayin, says the Gemara, is a stronger, more ironclad form of identification than Simanim. So all of this plays out with respect to, or played out with respect to identifying bodies in the aftermath of 9/11. So I remember that we had a program here at Yeshiva a few weeks after the tragedy of 9/11, when it became clear that we would have to resolve some of these Aguna issues, and we would have to figure out. How do you identify bodies? How do you collect testimony? In certain cases, we knew that we wouldn't find bodies altogether. We wouldn't find even fragments of bodies. We wouldn't have anything to rely upon. So what type of aidus, what type of testimony can we rely upon if people testify, oh, I spoke to the person that morning, and they were on their way to work? So do you assume, well, they must have made it to work since we didn't hear from them afterwards, so that means that they must be dead. So that's not necessarily good enough, according to halacha. What is considered to be good enough is what the Gemara refers to as Nafal Asal Kibshan Eish. You see that a witness sees that a person falls into a fiery furnace. And they fall into the fiery furnace, and it's a very deep fiery furnace, and there's no way that anybody without a miracle would be able to escape from that fiery furnace. Or you see somebody fall into Mayim Shem Yesh for himself. You see that a person falls into a circumscribed body of water where you can see the borders of the water, and you look for a few minutes, the amount of time that it would take for somebody to drown, and the person who fell into the water doesn't rise up from the water. So then you can testify that the person definitely is dead. It's Mayim Shein La himself. It's an uncircumscribed body of water like an ocean, so maybe you didn't see the person come out of the water, but a mile away the person came out of the water. So that wouldn't be considered to be good enough, even though it's probable that the person drowned, but it's not good enough because sometimes the person doesn't drown. So too, the Gemara says there are certain types of situations when you know for sure that the person would have died. So we collected testimony in certain cases that there was a firm called Cantor Fitzgerald. Cantor Fitzgerald was the firm that was on the upper stories of the North Tower of the World Trade Center, and the first plane that went into the World Trade Center towers, the one that went into the North Tower, hit the tower at around the 92nd floor of the tower, and it was a very clean break, so that the top of the building above the collision was completely severed from the bottom of the building. It didn't fall off immediately, but it was severed, so that all the points of ingress and egress were closed off. It was impossible to go down the stairwells. It was impossible to go down the elevator. So you knew that anybody who could be identified as being in the very top floors, and that was everybody who worked for this firm of Cantor Fitzgerald. There were 650 people who had showed up to work that day at the firm of Cantor Fitzgerald, and none of them were accounted for, so you knew that there was just no way they could have escaped. It was like Nafal Sokip Shonesh. Either they would have been incinerated by the flames, or they would have fallen over 100 stories towards a certain death, because the Gemara says that people can't survive a fall of 3 stories, so certainly a person can't survive a fall of 100 stories. So therefore, if we had testimony from a person who, let's say, was on the telephone with an individual who worked at Cantor Fitzgerald, we had a few such cases, and the witness told us, yeah, I spoke to so-and-so, I spoke to Plony, and Plony said, yeah, I heard that our building was just hit. I'm sitting in my office on the 103rd floor, and we're trying to figure out what to do in order to get out of here. So if they had that conversation, so that's considered to be good enough testimony, because that's basically testimony of Nafal Sokip Shonesh. The person was in a location at a certain point in time in which they could not possibly have survived. So that's with respect to testimony. That's with respect to collecting testimony. Yes?
Does that apply to all the floors above the hit?
It would apply to all the floors, anybody who worked on a floor that was above the 93rd floor, and you could identify that they were definitely there. But let's say you didn't have testimony that was so compelling. Let's say that nobody spoke to the person that day after they arrived at work. Or you have a case where a person was in a floor like in the South Tower. In the South Tower, there was, even after the South Tower was hit, the South Tower was not hit on the 92nd floor. It was hit in a zigzag fashion on the 78th floor. 78th floor is where they had the express elevator banks, but it was hit in a fashion in which there was still one stairwell that was passable. So even after the plane hit the South Tower, there were people who worked above at the point of impact who were able to escape. They were able to go out of this one smoky and difficult to navigate staircase. But about 15 people made their way down that staircase, and everybody else who was on the 78th floor above perished. There were even people above the 78th floor, below the 78th floor, who perished because the South Tower collapsed much more quickly after it was hit than the North Tower. So there were a number of people who didn't get out in time. But there you had a much more difficult case because it was more akin to what we would call Mayim She'elam. So it was more akin to a situation of a person who's seen falling into a body of water like an ocean, which is vast. And even if they didn't see them emerge, maybe they emerged at a much more distant location, which was beyond the visibility point of the aid. And here as well, even if it was known based on telephone conversations and the like that the person was in the South Tower above the 78th floor or below the 78th floor, there was still a chance that they could have gotten out. And therefore, that testimony alone was not really considered to be sufficient. So you needed more. You needed more evidence in order to be able to conclude halakhically that the individual was considered to have perished. And similarly, we had one case of a person who worked above the point of impact on the North Tower, but there was nobody who spoke to the person after the building was hit. So who knew for sure that the person was definitely in his office? Nobody spoke to the person after they came into the office that day. Nobody saw them come into the office. So in that particular case, we had what's called Raglayim Ledava. We had very strong circumstantial evidence. The Tumas Hadeshin says that you could be Matir and Eishes Ish if you're able to prove through very compelling, Umdana Demuchach, very compelling circumstantial evidence that the husband must have died. So what's an Umdana Demuchach? So in this particular case, the husband always went to his office in the World Trade Center taking the subway. And we were able to get a copy of his MetroCard records because he purchased his MetroCard with a credit card. And people purchase the MetroCard through cash, so there's no way to trace exactly their movements. But this person purchased the MetroCard with their credit card. The credit card indicated the MetroCard number. The Manhattan Transit Authority had all the records of all the MetroCard transactions. We saw that every single day he passed through the 42nd Street station on the way to work, and he always swiped his MetroCard at a certain time, and he made it to work a certain time later. And we saw on September 11th, he had swiped his MetroCard at a particular point in time. And not only that, but there were also people needed a swipe card to get into the building. So the swipe card records had been wiped out for the month of September, because when the World Trade Center tower was collapsed, so all of the swipe card records were there in the facility, so they were destroyed as well. But they had already stored the records for the month of August off-site, so we had the swipe card records for the month of August. So we saw, based on the month of August, how much time it normally took between when he swiped the card, the MetroCard, in the 42nd Street station, and when he would arrive at work, when he would go through the doors at work as a number of minutes later. So we saw that the longest amount of time that it took was something like 20 minutes. And we saw, based on the time that he had swiped his card in the 42nd Street station on that day, that the latest time he would have come into the building. And then we found out how long it normally took to take the elevator up to the floor where he worked and so forth, that the latest amount of time, based on all of the records, that he would have arrived at work, based on past patterns, would have been around 8:45 in the morning. And the plane hit the North Tower at around 8:47 in the morning. So we had very strong, compelling evidence that this person was in his office already at a point, at a location where he could not possibly have survived, based on an umdana demuchak. But not everybody says that you can rely upon this type of an umdana demuchak. It's based on a probability. But it's a probability which is totally b'maisa. It's a rova totally b'maisa, a probability which is dependent upon a person doing something, that they're going to, after they go in the subway, that we have a rove that they generally go to work. Maybe a person one day would not go to work. Maybe they would go shopping in a store and not go straight to their office. So therefore, that wasn't considered to be 100% either. So we needed to see if we had simonim that could be relied upon. So what's a simon mufok? So we had a program here at YU a couple of weeks after the tragedy, in which we had different speakers who were discussing the halakhic considerations and parameters. So Schechter got up and he said that this idea that a simon mufok has to be a simon that is shared by fewer than 1 in 1,000 people, that's only if you have a tragedy and 1,000 people are missing. But let's say you have a tragedy like the collapse of the World Trade Center Twin Towers, where 3,000 people were missing. So then he said it has to be a simon mufok, which would be found in less than 1 in 3,000 people. So we have to look for such simonim. So one person was identified. In fact, there was enough of the skull that was identified that the New York City Medical Examiner's Office was trying to extract simonim from whatever they would find on the site. So they were able to extract dental records, and the dental records matched that of an individual who was missing. We were able to rely upon that. There was another individual that they found pants on on fragments of skin and bones from the person's legs. Clearly, the legs had been severed from the rest of the body, and the person was clearly dead. And we were not able, nobody was able to identify the person through the body, but the pants themselves had the same pair of pants this person had worn that morning. But that's a simon gerua, because lots of people wear the same type of pants. However, it also had the person's wallet in it. And in the wallet, it had the person's driver's license and the person's credit cards. And in another pocket, there were the person's keys. And it also had their ring was in it. So these are things that, according to the Gemara, Dvarmit Lo Mushli Inshi, these are the types of objects that people don't normally lend out. And you can assume that this pair of pants was not... it was not somebody else's pair of pants that he had loaned out, that he hadn't loaned out his wallet or his ring or his keys to anybody else, and that all of this really did belong to him. And therefore, the post can say, when you have a lot, all of these are simanim beinonim, because it's not a simon mufok, because there's still a slight chance a person could have loaned their object. But nonetheless, the post can say, if you have a lot of these simanim together in one place, so that's considered to be a simon mufok. So even though this person worked in the South Tower, and there was a chance that he could have escaped, so we were able to identify him on that basis. But everybody else eventually was identified through something else that we had never relied upon before as a matter of halacha, and namely that's DNA identification. What's DNA identification? You've heard of DNA. DNA is that everybody has a special coding in their cells, that there's no same coding with respect to every single person, and you can extract a certain code, a certain type of fluid that is extracted from a person's cell, from the nucleus of the cell, that has an arrangement of different chromosomes, and everybody's arrangement is 99% similar, but that last 1% is different for every single person, and no two people, unless they're identical twins, no two people share the exact same DNA. There was nobody who was in an Aguna situation where we were dealing with an identical twin, and even if we were, we didn't have a situation where both identical twins would have been missing, so therefore that wasn't a concern, that wasn't a problem, and the question was whether we could rely upon DNA identification. So this was an issue that we were dealing with a few of the cases in our Bezdin. Because that case that I just described to you, the person where we had the umnin and the mukaf, if they would have made it to the office based on their MetroCard record, based on their past swipe card records, so they were able to find a DNA match based on fragments of bone or skin or tissue that that they were able to gather from the site. They compared it with this person's DNA records. How did they have this person's DNA records? You could take the person's shaver or the person's toothbrush or the person's comb and extract DNA. Another way you can extract DNA is extracting the DNA of the person's parents. That's called familial DNA. If you are able to make a match based on the person's own DNA, so then it's even more compelling. But even if you make a match based on the person's familial DNA, it's also pretty compelling. And we had to, and in that case, this person was identified through that DNA, and everybody else, with one exception, that we were struggling with, everyone else was also identified. We had maybe the four different cases where the people were identified through DNA identification. Every single time that the New York City Medical Examiner's Office would make an identification through DNA, they would send a fax to the office of the Bezdin, letting us know which individuals had been identified that day, so that we would be updated as to whether they were had made a match with respect to any of the people that we were charged with helping, because the wives had turned to us since their husbands were missing and they needed a psak from the Bezdin in order to be permitted to remarry. So we gathered in a shul, this was Rabbi Shlush's shul, congregation of Deris El, which is right near the New York City Medical Examiner's Office, so we could have a meeting with the experts in the New York City Medical Examiner's Office to understand the science of DNA identification. And I remember we were all there. I was there, I think Rabbi Rat was there, I think Rabbi Willard was there. And there were also a couple of representatives of the Bezdin in Lakewood, because the Bezdin in Lakewood was dealing with a case as well, where the person was known to have been in his office before the plane crashed into the building, but nobody spoke to him after the plane crashed into the building, and they were trying to figure out to what degree they could shtel a chazaka, that he was there beforehand, so he probably stayed there. But that's a questionable chazaka. Maybe he left the building in the interim. And they also needed some extra evidence to base their psak upon. So it turns out that when you make an identification through DNA, generally the margin of error is less than 1 in 1 trillion. We had one case where the margin of error was less than 1 quintillion. So it's a lot better than 1 in 1,000, a lot better even than 1 in 3,000. It's off the charts. Off the charts better. So the post can say you can rely upon fingerprint identification, you can rely upon dental x-rays, so it seemed like this should have been fine. But it was questionable in terms of the science a little bit, because how could there be billions and trillions of configurations? So one of the posts came from Lakewood, turned to the scientist from the New York City Medical Examiner's Office, I think his name was Dr. Howard Baum, and he asked him that the world has only been around for, 5,700 some years or so. We couldn't have had so many human beings that you'd have a quintillion different configurations. So how can we rely upon DNA science? So nobody was that concerned about that question. So the other concerns regarding the DNA identification were that it's not visible to the naked eye. When we speak about simanim, generally speaking, simanim are visible. The nikar le'einayim, those are the simanim. You know that a person had a certain wart, they had a certain weirdly shaped nose, they had certain defects and incisions on their teeth or whatever the case may be. Here you're not looking at anything. It's all, you know, this acid which is derived from the person's cells and from the skin, from the tissue, but it's not the DNA combinations. You can see the tissue, but you're not identifying the person based on their unique tissue. You're identifying them based on their unique coating, which is inside of the skin or inside of the tissue or inside of the bone. So how can you rely upon this as a matter of halacha? So Zalman Nechemya Goldberg thought that wasn't an issue. Zalman Nechemya Goldberg said, this is not really a case of simanim. Simanim is maybe when I'm looking at something with a visible eye, but I can argue that this is stronger than simanim. This is a case of like Tfiyas Ayin. How does Tfiyas Ayin work? Tfiyas Ayin, when I look at a person, I'm not looking at a particular simen. I'm not identifying them based on the size of something, based on the shape of something. I'm identifying them because they have a very unique look. HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't create any two people with exactly the same look. This person has a very unique look, and I know I'm able to just appear at the I'm able to gaze at the person and say, I know that this is Ploni. I know this is Chaim. I know that this is Yankel. I can just tell without identifying any specific dimensions or measurements or the like. So he said it's the same thing with respect to DNA, that just like everybody has a unique appearance, so they have a unique coating in their skin. It's not that I'm necessarily taking a measurement or I'm identifying a particular dimension. It's that there's a certain uniqueness to the individual. It's the same way that we say Tfiyas Ayin is considered to be a very powerful identification, maybe even better than a Simen Mubah. We could kill based that you could administer capital punishment based on Tfiyas Ayin. So too, DNA is no worse than Tfiyas Ayin. So that was the argument of Zalman Nechemya Goldberg. Others said, no, it's like Simanim. Who said that Simanim have to be visible? And whether they're visible or not, if I'm able to extract something, just like I'm able to look at a pair of pants and look at what the size was on the tag, and that's some sort of a simen, even if when I look at the pants, I can't tell the size, but I see the tag, so I know that this person, you know, had this type of a size pants. So this also, I'm looking at the tag inside of the skin. The tag inside of the skin has this type of a coating, so that also counts as a simen. But then there's a separate problem. What's the separate problem? The problem is that the mama Paskins that not only is a simen benoni not good enough to allow a woman to remarry, you need a simen mufak, but let's say I have a bunch of simanim benonim. I have that I remember that the person is this height and there happen to be this weight and they happen to wear this type of a style of pants and this type of style of shirt, and each one of the things are maybe types of items where one in 500 people share the same measurement or share the same style clothes or share the same type of work. But there's no single point of identification which is unique to one individual that you would not have more than, that you would have no more than 1 in 1,000 who would have this type of identification. Every single one taken by themselves, if you had 1,000 people, so it's possible that you would have 2 people who would share this simen. So if you have a conglomeration of all of those simanim together, so the Rama says even a conglomeration is not good enough. So therefore the question is that the DNA coding, if you take one pair of chromosomes, So then that might be something which is a simen benoni. What turns it into a simen mufak? When I have a whole pairing, when I have a whole combination, a whole ma'arechet, I have a continuation of like 17 different loci of chromosomes that are matched together in a particular way. It's the pattern itself which provides for the simen, which provides for the uniqueness of the identification. Maybe that pattern is just considered to be a conglomeration of simanim beinonim. So Rabbi Eliyahu Levin, who's the head of the Choshen Mishpah Kollel in Lakewood, said no. He disagreed with that critique of relying upon DNA identification. He said that it's different because here it's not that that you're relying upon a combination of simanim benonim, of every single pairing being a simen benoni, and I'm putting all these pairings of chromosomes together in order to create a simen mufak. The Seder itself, the pattern itself, that's the simen. It's just not the combination of simanim, but the pattern is itself gufa the simen. Mendelssohn Rovick has a tshuva on this, and they say in his sefer, Atzei Besomim, he was also involved in the Shakla B'Darya, and he brings rayos that, for example, a number of the achronim speak about that if you have a combination of simanim in one particular organ, that you recognize that this person had an eye that was blind and it was protruding from the face, and it had pus coming from it, and it had, and all of these three different things together, and you found the body, even though you couldn't otherwise recognize the body, that had all of these three weird things in the eye that came together. So that is considered to be a siman mufak, because it's all within one aver. So he said here too, it's all considered to be one marechet, it's considered to be one seder, it's considered to be one pattern. So therefore, we felt comfortable based on all of the shikulim to rely upon DNA identification. But there was a tshuva by Rav Shmuel Vozna. Rav Shmuel Vozna had been asked this question in connection with the identification of halalim, of terror victims in Eretz Yisrael. To what degree, when the body had been completely destroyed, can you rely upon DNA identification? So he had written that it can only be relied upon as a korob, with siman mufak. That you needed other types of umdenus, you needed other types of evidence in addition to the DNA identification. So fortunately, even if you hold, and most poskim nowadays don't hold like that standard, they hold that the DNA identification is a siman mufak by itself, but even if you would hold by the requirement of Shmuel Vozner that there be other forms of evidence. So in every single one of these cases, there were people who knew that the individual had been in the building, or we had an umden of the mukhak that the person was in the building in a place where most people died. So we already had a probability that the person was dead, and the DNA was just some added evidence that put us over the top, so to speak, and therefore we were able to rely upon that in terms of identifying the victims, unfortunately, as having died, so that the wives would be allowed to remarry. One suggestion as to why it is that Rav Shmuel Vozner said that it's only a korov l'siman mufak is because if he would say that it's absolutely a, that he had a reservation about saying it's absolutely a siman mufak, and you find this in a number of the poskim nowadays as well. What's the reservation? So one thing you can give a simple explanation, that he was concerned about some of these other arguments, right? The argument that maybe it's a combination of siman and benonim, the argument that it's not visible to the eyes, and those considerations, not to make it like a classical siman mufak, it's just karov, the siman mufak. So we understand that. But there's also a practical consideration, which is, once you say DNA identification is a siman mufak, so then what happens when you do, just in the normal course, a DNA identification of somebody and you discover that the person they thought was their father was not really their father, and the real father was, according to DNA identification, was the man who lived next door. Therefore, they end up being a mamzer. So you don't want to create mamzeris. Lo yibah mamzer b'kal Hashem. That's also in this week's parsha. We want to avoid having mamzerim. And if you say that DNA identification is just 100% ironclad and incontrovertible, so then you'll end up with potential mamzeris in your midst. So others have other terutzim to that. Avosha Weiss writes that we have a special din when it comes to mamzeris, that mamzeris can only be identified either through two kosher edim who testify about a ma'aseh nus, or through Yakir, through the father of somebody saying, "Oh, this child, you know, is really mine is really a mamzer." But if you don't have any of those triggers, so then you can't create mamzeris, even if you have DNA identification. And furthermore, Rabbi Willig argues that since Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva that says that let's say a woman has a child with a man who is not her husband, who's, let's say, another man who's not her husband, and the child is born, but she didn't have relations with the man. She only had artificial insemination from the man's zera, that it didn't take place through intercourse. So the child's going to have the DNA of the other man. Rav Moshe says that unless there's prohibited intercourse, the child's not going to be a mamzer. So therefore you could say, oh, maybe that even if we prove that the child has the DNA of from another man, nonetheless, that would not prove that there was a prohibited sexual relationship in order to create mamzeris. Maybe the child was born through artificial insemination. And Rav Asher Weiss has another argument as well, which is that the Tzitz Eliezer says that you can never rely upon newfangled science. So he didn't want to identify, didn't want to rely upon paternity tests with blood tests, because he says, who knows, 30, 40 years from now, maybe they'll say that this test is not good anymore. So most posts can say, once the scientists say that it's reliable, after a while we can assume that it's reliable when it's worked enough times. But Vasha Weiss says that that's only if it's going to help people. But if it's going to negatively and adversely affect all future generations, so then we go back to the Svar of the Tzitz Eliezer, that maybe 500 years from now,
there'll be a different understanding of DNA, and it will turn out that it's not as ironclad as we had thought. So now we can rely upon it to help people, to not make people, I'm saying, to be materinacious, to be materinacious, a woman who would otherwise be an aguna, but in order to condemn all future generations that are going to be descendants of this person, that they should be mamzerim forever, so then we don't rely as much upon the science. So be it as it may, we don't worry so much about the ramifications with respect to mamzeris. Rabbi Yashiv has a shuvah in the Kovetz Shuvos where a woman had an affair and she wanted to make sure, and she thought that her child was from the paramour, not from her real husband, and she asked the question, am I mechuyev to do a DNA test in order to see whether this child is really a mamzer? Rabbi Yashiv said, you had better not do that. That's a very bad idea, that you don't look for problems when it comes to mamzer's issues. He says, if you leave it alone, so then everything will be much better, and we'll assume Robilo's hokin akarabal, and the child's not a mamzer, but just please, you know, leave it alone. I had a shiloh like that as well. A girl called me up. She's like 25 years old. She's already married, has a family, but she never had closure because she always was under the assumption that she was really the child, not of her father, but of a man that her mother was having an affair with. And she wanted to know, just for the sake of her psychological well-being, that she wanted to do a DNA test, and this way she would know for sure. So she wanted to know if that was a good idea. So that's a really bad idea. It's a really bad idea. You'll have much better closure, and your children will have much better closure, and all future generations will have much better closure if you never do that DNA test. But even if the DNA test would be done, so there are poskim who are makel about it. But certainly, with respect to being matir and aguna, so we came to the conclusion, unfortunately, in the backdrop of this terrible tragedy, but we were able to develop halacha in terms of defining the parameters of relying upon the DNA identification, and Bezrat Hashem, we shouldn't have to utilize this chachma for similar situations in the future. We should know of no further tragedy. Yes.
Did Rashi specify in the case the woman who was sent for the son, with regards to whether the child is going, which way you go with that, and then leave the son, don't do the DNA test, leave the son as the chazak of the father? Did he say?
I don't think there was a kahuna. There was a kohen alevi-ish. I think that the father was a Yisrael. So, but he would say, yeah, that if the father, the real husband, meaning the regular husband of the mother was a kohen or a levi, so then the child would be presumed to be a kohen or a levi based on Mobilos Hokin Akaraba. Yeah. It's a complicated case because she had received a tshuva from a certain rav, and that rav was no longer necessarily in good standing. But so she wanted to know whether the tshuva that she had received, that was the first question, whether the tshuva was a good tshuva, because she got married based on the tshuva of this rav that she could rely upon Mobilos Hokin Akaraba. She said that rav, it wasn't. The Rav was never defrocked, so to speak. He left his pulpit because of things that were going on. But he was never defrocked, and nobody ever questioned the psalkim that this Rav had issued. And it was known that he had consulted very closely with Rav David Feinstein when he had issued this psalk. I advised him. I said, you have somebody intercede and go to Rav David Feinstein and have him just, you know, write, since he was familiar with the case, a little, you know, gamanim et starf lehetzer anal, you know, on the bottom of the psak that Rav had written, you know, a few years earlier. And I said, that yes, it says that's probably a good idea. That's how the conversation began. Then, just as like a secondary point, she said, oh, you know, I'm planning to do his DNA test. That was, it was like, it's okay, yeah.
Was
Haven
DNA good?
Aiden for sure are good. So Aiden, we know. That's the most powerful type of testimony, is Api Shnayim Aiden, Shoshayidim, Yimas Ames. So we know that Aiden, that's last week's parsha, we know that Aiden are always considered to be reliable. So you have, and when it comes to Mimatim and Aguna, the Gemara in Yavama says, we even rely upon Aid Echad. I mean, for Takanas Agunas. So Mishum Takana, Mishum Aguna Akilu Bei Rabbanan is the expression of the Gemara. That in order that women not be an aguna, so we rely even upon one witness. And then there's a whole alumnus. Why? How could one witness ever be good enough? So the answer is, it's one witness together with Isha Daika Mintzava, and the fact that the woman's not going to rely upon this witness unless she knows that the testimony is really reliable, because she doesn't want to end up being an Isha Sish if it should turn out the husband's really alive. So so we rely, when it comes to aguna situations, on Eid Echad. Yeah.
Could there ever be DNA and you
You mean that somebody shows up and he claims that he's really the missing husband, then we do a DNA test and it turns out that the DNA test matches the DNA of the missing husband. Like, we don't recognize the man. He doesn't look anything like the previous husband looked, you mean? Like,
either that, or if you have Edom saying something and the DNA test contradicts them. I guess either DNA versus...
Let's say you have Edom to testify that that this person is the one who committed the murder. And then we have DNA that connects somebody else to the murder.
No. Something like that. I mean, I was thinking either Lahakel or Lahafmir, but I guess Lahakel would be a simpler case.
Yes.
We probably wouldn't put somebody to death. So Rav Shmuel Vosner says you wouldn't put somebody to death based on a DNA identification because we have Xavier Sokosov, a Bishnai made the Mashal Shaydim Masamase. That even the most ironclad form of identity, even what the Gemara and Chula is talking about, Tfiyas Ayin, it's not just without Adim, it's the Adim who identify the murderer based on Tfiyas Ayin. But you need Adim. If you don't have Adim and you only have DNA, so we wouldn't put somebody to death based on that. That's the Sugya Shimon ben Shetach, Erev ben Nechama. Shimon ben Shetach saw a situation where it was such an umdan of the Muchak that someone committed the murder. He saw, they say, a would-be murderer running after somebody with a knife, screaming, I'm going to get you, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill you. And then they run into a chorp, or they run into a desolate area. And then he comes into the desolate area, and he sees that the intended victim is lying on the ground, and the blood is pouring out of his body. And the murderer is standing over him with a knife saying, ha, 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 ha. And Shimon ben Shetach said that even though it was quite clear what had happened, you can't put that person to death because the Torah says, Shnai Meidim Shol Shedim Yimasame. So the poskim say, it's the same thing here. If you don't have Shnai Meidim, even if you have DNA, you can't put someone, Api Halacha, you can't put someone to death based on DNA. That's what we generally assume.
What,
yeah.
What if in a Aguna case, the DNA tested he was dead, but then...
In other words, we're able to identify the body as being that of the victim. Now two Adim come along and say, what do you mean you're identifying Plony? We just saw Plony yesterday. It was in Miami. We were in a spa together, and he's perfectly healthy. He's 100% fine. I don't know. That would be a very difficult case. I don't know. Yeah.
If DNA is similar to TSIN, would it also work by Hashavas Veda? Meaning if someone lost something and do a DNA?
Apipashis, I don't know what, I mean, DNA goes for like living being. I mean, they lost a dog. They lost a dog and were able to identify the dog based on DNA. Maybe, yeah. That'd be interesting. Be very interesting, yeah. I don't know. There'd have to be that, what's the Tfiyah sign? Like, say, we trust the Talmud Chacham, so he comes to identify the lost object. So he says, you know what, I can't tell for sure that it's my dog, but why don't you do a DNA test? Because I know that the DNA combination is as follows, and you see that it matches what he knew that it was. Okay, yes.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. I don't know. Maybe in that case, we would say it's not your typical TFSI. Maybe we would rely upon somebody if they weren't a Talmud Chacham in that case. Remember, so Rosam Nechemia is saying in a way that it's better than Simanim, it's TFSI, but that doesn't mean that it wouldn't count the Simanim as well. You know, it could be we would rely upon that even if you weren't a Talmud Chacham. Yeah. Yeah. Some say so. It's a machlokis. I mean, the Ramah is not the last word on the subject, but the Ramah paskins that way, and he is the Ramah, so we have to worry about a shita. But the Yotzer poskim have a number quotes. A number of poskim would disagree with the Ramah. They say that if not, you're right. If you have lots and lots of simanim benom together, so basically the pshara is it depends how much they really are indicative of a pattern, and how much each one could really be explained away in its own right as being sort of coincidental that they came together. So if the way that they're presented, like in one organ, or in one marechet or one pattern, is such that it's clear that they all come together on some level, so then we're more likely to rely upon it.
Like if a person has like a weird hand and a weird foot and a weird ear,
But let's say a person like wore a weird hat and a weird sweater. So could be that okay. Normally, you either wear the weird hat or the weird sweater, but not both. But you can't say for sure that that should be sufficient to rely upon. So it depends. Yeah.
So the case where the wallet, like the phone, and the car keys, and his pockets, that was an attachment of Simon.
That was a case where we did rely upon the combination. We were relying upon two things. Number one, the combination of Simon and Benonim. And number two, the fact that this was in the category of what we call Kalim de lo Mushli Enchi, the type of utensils that people don't normally loan out. The Gemara indicates that there's a possibility that if there are certain types of items that a person doesn't normally loan out, so then that is, you know, itself sufficient to rely upon, and assuming that the body that's inside of this clothing is the body of the missing individual. Yeah.
Why are these credit cards or driver's licenses not as the look on? They have the guy's name on it.
The reason is Asim and Mumak is because we just don't know if he ended up lending it to somebody else. That's why we have to say that. In other words, how do we know that we can rely upon the Chazak of Kendla Moshli Enchi? It's a question. Whether, you know, because sometimes maybe a person would have, you know, loaned it out to, you know, on a whim, or, you know, somebody needed to buy an item in the store, said, here, borrow my wallet for a second, whatever it is, you know. So we say the fact that it wasn't only the wallet, or that he didn't just give the wallet, but he left his driver's license inside, which people, you know, don't normally do, and he also had the keys in the pocket, so that strengthens, you know, the argument. Strengthens the argument. Yeah.
When we said that the DNA thing, if we were to allow it to work, that it would be a problem of monetary, that, like, we want to avoid that. But, like, I just didn't understand, like, if that's, like, the reality, when we want, if we want to avoid something, but if that's really is it, like, we're avoiding, what does it mean to avoid monetary?
Because there's a special, the Shev Shmaitasa has an essay, the first simon of the Shev Shmaitasa. So he talks about how when it comes to Mamzerus is different from many other Yisurim in the Torah. It's not something that objectively exists. It only exists if you have a Yediyah. Because the Torah says, Lo Yavo Mamzer B'Kal Hashem. And the Gemara derives Mamzer Vade Lo Yavo Ba Mamzer Sofik Yavo. That if that only if a person is a Mamzer Vada, you see also, but if it's a Sofik, you don't know for sure that the person is a Mamzer, so that doesn't count as Mamzerus. So Chonon Wasserman has an essay about this in his Ha'aros in the Shev Shmaitasa, in which he says that basically it's one of these things that is only usher if you actually have Yediyah. It's like Orla and Chutzlaritz. So Orla and Chutzlaritz, even if there's a probability that the fruit that I'm going to buy in the store comes from fruit from the first 3 years of existence, so the halakha l'moshe misinai b'chutzlaritz is only if I know for a fact. Even if I'm pretty sure, but I haven't been able to, I haven't verified it. Nobody has told it to me. It doesn't have the tag on it saying exactly when this tree was planted. So even though, according to normal principles of Roven Chazaka, this fruit probably came from a tree during the first 3 years of its existence, since I don't have a Yediyah Badai, so it's going to be Mutta for me. So he says it's the same thing with respect to Mamzeru. So Yitzchok Sabav Ochanan Wasserman goes so far as to say that I could be Masadar Kiddushin for somebody that I know is a Mamzer, as long as he doesn't know that he's a Mamzer. I don't know that people paskin that. It's a halach lemaisa. I remember that I once had a difficult Mamzerus case in the Beis Din of America, and I sent a shaila to Rabbi Avayi Yosef, and I quoted Rabbi Yitzchok of Chonon Wasserman, asking whether this is something that could be relied upon. So the tshuva didn't mention the article of Chonon Wasserman. I don't think it's quoted so much, but there is that sense, certainly, that if nobody knows about it, I don't know about it, and the other person doesn't know about it either. So there's certain types of investigation that are normal that you're supposed to do. You're supposed to look at marriage and divorce records of parents and grandparents that's readily available, but it's not considered to be de rigueur. That every single person has to submit themselves to a DNA test when we already have a chazaka, pi halacha, that a person is presumed to be the child of their father, even if it's known that the mother was having an affair. So then you're allowed, pi halacha, to rely upon that chazaka, and you're not obligated to look for problems. And even if, objectively speaking, the DNA test would indicate that somebody else was the father, it doesn't matter that the halacha is that mamzer, you know, badai yosav achmana, that as long as the person is not a mamzer badai, so then they're going to be mutter in that situation. Rabbi Chonon Wasserman Rabbi Yashiv explains the quotes of Rashash. That's the reason that he says that Rabbi Bana didn't do any kind of a blood test to indicate who the father was when there was a man who was, before he died, he overheard his wife saying to to her daughter, you should be more tsunua than I was, because your father and I, we have 10 children, we have 10 sons, and only one of them is your father's biological son. That everybody else came from different men. You should be more tsunua than I was. I wasn't so good in that respect. So he realized that he only had one son that was a legitimate son. So he said, before he died, I want all my nechasim to go to my son, to my real son. So then he died, and they turned to Rabbi Bana and said, how are we going to identify the real son? So Rabbi Bana said, have the sons go to his grave and knock on the grave, and the one that the grave is going to respond to, it'll like start shaking and start moving, so that's the one that's the real son. The grave will tell you who the real son is. So 9 out of the 10 sons, and they went and they knocked on the grave, and the grave was not potsepem mitzapsep. It didn't in korven koshep. It didn't respond at all. So Rabbi Bana said, so the real son is the one who didn't go to knock on the father's grave, because that shows that, you know, he had proper midos, so, you know, he must be the non-mamzer, the one who didn't knock on the father's grave. So the Rashbam says, not that this was really a foolproof test to show that the other were mamzerim. It's like a shuda de daini, that he probably wanted his nechasim to go to the son who had the best midos. The one who didn't knock on the grave was the one with the best midos. Whether he was a mamzer, he was the one who had the best midos. So the Rashash says that he doesn't understand why didn't he do a blood test, because there's a story in the Sefer Chassidim of Rav Sajid Gaon, when there was a question as to which of two sons was the real legitimate son of a man who died, which of two people. One was the Eved, and one was the son. And the man had gone on a trip with his pregnant wife and an Eved, and then he died, and the Eved claimed that he was the son. And in the meantime, the mother, she must have died in childbirth or something, gave birth to this little baby. But the Eved said, I'm really the son, and he received all the nechasim of this rich man. And then the child grew up, and he found out what happened. And he said, this Eved took away all of the nechasim that belonged to me, that was supposed to go to me, but Yerusha. And he claimed that he was my father's son. How can I prove that he's not really the son? I am the son. So he went to Rav Sajja Gaon's house, and he cried to Rav Sajja, and Rav Sajja got permission from the emperor, wherever he lived. He got permission that he was allowed to adjudicate this case. So he brought the Eved and the son in, and he got a blood sample from the father's body. I have no idea how he got a blood sample from the father's body. But he got a blood sample from the father's body, and then they took a bone from the... took a bone. So a bone from the father's body, and then he extracted blood from both the Eved and the son. And the blood of the son got absorbed into the bone, and the blood of the Eved did not get absorbed into the bone. So he said, so this proves, because scientifically, if it was really the son, so the bone would, the blood would get absorbed into the bone. So this shows that this is the son, and this one's not the son, and all the nechasim were taken away from the Eved and were given to the rightful son. That's the end of the story. So the question is asked, the Rashash quotes the question, why is it that Rabbi Bana didn't utilize the same test in order, if this is such a good test that Rav Sajja Gaon had, so why didn't Rabbi Bana use the same test? So the Rashash answers that he didn't want to create Mamzeris. That if he would have used this test, the test would have been 100% conclusive. It would have been 100% conclusive. So it would have shown which was the real son, but it would have shown that everybody else was definitely a Mamzer. He didn't want to create Mamzeris. So Rabbi Yoshi quotes that Rashash and says that we follow the same protocol, that we don't look to create Mamzeris. Yeah. Okay, stop here. Everybody have a good Shabbos.
So it only goes to
Yeah.
So it's only Kobeya with regards to Yerusha?
Is it Kobeya with respect to Yerusha? So
It sounds
like if you have a good blood test, so that it would be correct for purposes of Yerusha.
It's
not
going to be answered.
The value of your safe in the life is crazy. We don't know exactly what he was doing himself, but sort of an outlying story. We don't rely upon it because you can't prove to a blood test, because you can't prove to a blood test who the father is. Blood can only determine who the mother is, not who the father is. Because the Gemara Nita says that everything red
in a child, the Edom comes from the mother, and it's a girsa that this specifically includes the blood, right? It says the Gemara in the Amida talks about like the bubbles come from the father, and the red that comes from the mother, the white comes from the father, and the red comes from the mother, and it has a whole great message of course from which it says, according to the Amida Gemara. The Gemara is that the blood only comes from the mother, not from the father. So how can you rely upon a blood test when it's negative tomorrow to prove paternity, to prove who the father is and who the father isn't? So therefore he said that he didn't believe in relying upon it, and Rabbi Shash also said this, and Rabbi Ziel, Ben Sion Ziel, was the one who started this. He was the first Jew on the subject, bringing the right from Gemara Mitzvah, you can't rely upon a blood test. And a whole bunch of folks can follow suit, the Sicilias and the Zvadia, and so they always rejected these things. And Rav Herzog said, you're crazy. Rav Herzog said, you're like the ostrich that puts its head in the sand. If the scientists indicate that you can determine paternity this way, and you know, they've done this over and over again, it's proven to be an accurate test. So we look like fools. We look like fools, he said. If we're not going to rely upon contemporary science, we'll look like we do like voodoo and witchcraft. So we felt that it should be something that's relied upon.
And then if you can, it's just like from that you can have your cake and eat it too. Guys, that kids like guys and moms are, and you still solve the usual.
They didn't bring it so much for Monsegos, because they bought it, you know, in order to do paternity for child support. That was how, you know, the Batei Din wanted to use these paternity tests. The paternity test couldn't prove fatherhood, but they could disprove fatherhood, because let's say they have a mother who's an A, like blood type A, and a child that's an O. So then the father has to be either an A or an B. He can't be an O. So if you do a blood test on this person, you presume father, and you see that he's a B or an O, so then you know he's not really the father. But you know, you show that he's an A, so that doesn't prove that he's the father.
Somebody else is an A, you know.
Right, so then, it's based on DNA, so it's what you say, as far as I can tell, that better chuba uses the word DNA, but it's like at least one chuba, but they're trying to prove, you know, that somebody's definitely a problem. It would only make sense if it was using DNA. Rabbi Yosef says the same chuba. He says, no, based on the Gemara, we don't follow these things. But that's a little peculiar, because DNA is something that can be measured without reliance upon blood. You can extract DNA from bone, you can extract DNA from skin, from tissue. So, in fact, when they came up with the mitochondrial DNA, which is a special DNA that's only found in the mother, and the mother cells, so if I do your say, well, it's that putting somebody's Jewishness, which is now a new thing on the itself. Yeah. Somebody's Jewishness with mitochondrial DNA, who says that's something even my father.
Listen, what
because the Gemara says, because the Gemara says, it comes from Yitzchak Yosef, says, coming from the mother. So therefore, you know, my father's objection is that we can't do these things from the father. But if it's coming from the mother, so then for sure it's true. If I didn't understand that comment, he wrote this in Dhamma, the sacred Bira Yadis, because the fellow who did all the research in the mitochondrial DNA wrote a sacred Bira Yadis, and has a stomach, so a double loud one from Yitzchak Yosef. So, I mean, not necessarily a stomach that you'd be like, one of those stomachs that he did a nice job of collecting on the page. So Yitzchak Yosef said, I think this is something that could be relied upon, certainly together with other factors, because even my father would be comfortable with this, because I'm the mother, not the father. Even if my father, he had Dua, didn't rely upon blood tests, and didn't rely upon DNA. So I understand, but what's wrong with DNA? If DNA is being extracted not from blood, it's being extracted from other parts of the body, so what does that have to do with the DNA? So I didn't understand that comment. Yeah.
What's the difference? Why do we check marital records but don't check DNA for non-zeros? Like, they're both things that are easy to do, and they're both things that are...
Because in the case of non-zeros, so we have a presumption that we're starting off with, the Gobi was helping a common box. So therefore, I don't have a problem. But when it comes to marital records, it's different. Like, when am I going to say Rabbi Yosef and Acharbal? When the wife and the husband were still under the same roof. Let's say the wife got divorced, and then another man came into the picture, and then